Subway has teamed up with Live Nation to bring you great food and great music for a great value. Right now, buy a Subway $5 footlong and get a Live Nation concert ticket for $5 to participating Live Nation shows like Nickelback, The Fray, and Crew Fest 2. Ticket price does not include fees. See store for details. Subway. Eat fresh.
Eat fresh.
The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, what a day in Southern California. Holy mackerel, the ESPYs are tonight. You can feel the tension. You really can. It's like the Oscars, but bigger. And who better to join us but our old friend on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline, Mr. Chris Connolly. What's happening?
Not so much, Bill.
What you're not involved
in your fabulous world.
You're not involved with the ESPYs tonight.
They don't have a pregame show. In fact, like they have in the past. In fact, you know, I've been watching Erin Andrews very carefully over the last couple of months just to see if she was going to show any sign of emotion. You know, the fact that we would not be working the red carpet together. And you know, during the College World Series, I don't know. I was just kind of sensing maybe some inner melancholy. Maybe it's something only I got, but regrettably, no.
You know what? The foul ball, she threw herself in front of it because that's how she wanted it. Actually, she was in so much pain, she wanted to transfer the pain to other parts of her body because she misses you so much.
Part of the thing that was so fun about working with her is just being able to tell people for the next 12 months how much fun it is to work with her. If you were going to sit in a room and dream up a personality for her, it would be exactly what it is. She's close to her family. She's fun. She's loose. She tells jokes. She's great. So,
You know what, though? Let me tell you something. I don't care that you're not at the ESPYs because as far as I'm concerned, this is still the month of Chris Connolly.
Well,
you're everywhere. I mean, I haven't checked those Mediaite rankings since the first day. But you should be number one.
You kind of hitting the refresh on the Mediaite thing. Okay. Well, I can tell you that I have also checked myself on Twitter. I'm not on Twitter, but like when I did those NBA stories, I wanted to see what people were saying.
Yeah.
And the opinion is unanimous on me.
Yeah.
I'm really old.
Oh. Come on.
I am. I'm just saying. That's what they said. Damn, Chris Connolly is old. I didn't know there were so many different ways to type those things. Wow, Chris Connolly is old. Wow, Chris Connolly is really old.
So, but what made you seem older this year than last year?
I guess it's, you know, I don't know. Well, you know, the gray hair doesn't go back the other direction. Let's put it that way.
Oh.
So that could be it. But
hold on. I had an
older
idea.
Too, you know, that's people who may remember my younger, cuter days on MTV have also gotten older. So
you're more
I'm like a horrible reminder that it's 2009 in everyone's life.
I had an idea because I saw this picture of former Ferris Bueller, now Matthew Broderick.
Sure.
With his wife, Sarah Jessica Parker, a.k.a. Carrie Bradshaw. And they're twins who she had, apparently, even though she's like 55 years old. And Matthew Broderick now full gray.
Is that right, really?
Yeah, right. Salt and pepper, but gray and jarringly gray. Like out of nowhere, there's been no hint at it. He must have been coloring his hair, and now he's gray. But I thought this would be a good website of celebrities who have gone gray.
Interesting.
And it would be like, oh, we have an update. Matthew Broderick's gone gray. And by the way, I'm probably on there too because I'm going gray even though I'm not a celebrity. But I want to know these things. I want to know when a celebrity has passed the, I'm just, screw it, I'm not going to color my hair anymore.
I'm moving right into the fathers and district attorneys era of my career. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Well, that's the Ferris Bueller sequel, I think, is out now. I don't think you can pull it off.
Mike Nichols, I was told, once said that the most Yiddish-sounding, non-Yiddish quality is boyish appeal.
Mm.
He has what we'd like to call boyish appeal.
Yeah.
And so when you let yourself go gray, you no longer have what we like to say, boyish appeal.
Well, that's a great segue, boyish appeal. Let's talk about Michael Jackson.
Sure.
So somehow you became one of the big power brokers in this thing because of this Joe Jackson.
I think power broker would be.
I'm going to say I'm
perhaps
from...
a misnomer. Robert Moses was a power broker. I was a grateful correspondent.
Well, I think you should have been bumped up the Mediaite rankings for your Joe Jackson material. But
I have to figure out who my Peter King is.
So
I have to put a target. I haven't read all the metrics yet, so I'm way behind on what I need to do. And I do TV, Bill, so I got to get going.
So this was like a 27-part interview with Joe Jackson. In fact, you're still interviewing him. You're taking a break from it right now.
It was maybe 35 minutes, maybe 40 minutes, but it's been, we have used it a fair amount on ABC. There was an hour special last night, and it's turned up as you refer to on other ABC programs in the last few days.
Is this a person that you like?
I was fascinated by Joe. You know, Joe, you would recognize a guy like Joe instantly, Bill, because it's like talking to a 50s boxer.
Right.
You know, when you're sitting across from him, really what you want to go is, Carmine Basilio, was he really a wing?
Billy Kahn, does he have any regrets?
When you put Rocky Graziano down in the fifth, you know, I was watching on ESPN Classic. Like, did you...
That was really
the feeling I got. It was like, you know, it was like, wow. What was it like in those days when... everybody was smoking around ringside, and you had to keep boxing. So.
Were there any ground rules set? Did he say you can't ask me about this?
No. It was. You know, they always Biff Henderson. You remember from, you know, from the David Letterman show. The thing they always told you there was hit the chair and go. When you get out there, hit the chair and go.
Good move. That's what we did with the podcast today.
That's absolutely right. We hit the chair and go.
Yeah.
And you just have to make sure the chair doesn't hit back. So that's what I did. We just sort of hit the chair and go. We had like very, very short amount of time to set up, and our crew did an amazing job doing it. And then we were up and running. So
you've been in Los Angeles. What are you now in the 2022 year mark? 19 years.
Pardon me.
How many years in Los Angeles?
20 this year.
20. Okay.
My wife still says it's the boyfriend in whose arms you don't want to die.
Yep, and you've been renting the whole time, which I used to make fun of you for, and now I totally respect, and you're kind of a genius.
I that's exactly what I was telling myself the other day. Yeah.
The Michael Jackson.
It's time for someone to fix this fuse, that kind
right.
of thing.
The Michael Jackson.
The ability to lay it off on an unseen person, yeah.
Michael Jackson, the death and the fallout and the reaction publicly, yeah. The memorial, all that stuff. Top five. Kind of most surreal stretches you've had since you moved to Los Angeles?
Unquestionably, yeah. And as you note, Bill, the level of surreality is pretty high.
Yeah.
We had an earthquake. We had a riot. We had OJ, you know.
Well, give me rankings. Give me immediate rankings of Chris Connolly's top five strangest L.A. moments.
I'm gonna go with the Rodney King verdict and the riot number one.
Okay.
Then I'll go with OJ number two.
Right.
And then I'll go with the fires, not these last fires, but the fires a few years ago, number three. And then I'll go with the earthquake. Did I ever say the earthquake? The earthquake number four. So.
And then
Michael's
five?
In there at five, yeah.
I think he should be a little higher.
Okay. Well, maybe we're too close to it now. Maybe we don't really know yet.
I just the whole thing, the outpouring of affection coupled with everybody's just their willingness to just throw away basically the last 16, 17 years, just, throw it away. Let's talk about his music. I'm not saying it was bad or good. I'm just surprised at the way culture works these days. I'm surprised that's how it played out.
Well, you know, I was thinking about the different, strands of our culture and stuff. Because as you know, I began as a music writer and then I wound up doing this. And in fact, I was the guy who reviewed Thriller for Rolling Stone. Some 26 years ago, and gave it 4 stars out of 5.
No.
Yeah.
4 stars out of 5.
Yeah.
What? Because The Girl Is Mine, you downgraded a star.
The number
that
one,
so bad?
The first single off the record, Bill. The Girl Is Mine. The first single off the record.
Oh, that's
the
forgotten.
The lamest thing that I thought I'd ever heard.
Yeah.
No 5-star album has The Girl Is Mine on it. You know what the first single off of 1999 was?
What?
1999.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, if they'd had, like, remember State of Shock, which came out like... Now, if State of Shock had been on that record instead of The Girl Is Mine, that's a 5-star album.
You know what's funny? I was, for some reason, was thinking about, I actually found Thriller and listened to it. I've had this Michael Jackson, just all that. I've gotten swept up in a little bit, but.
What format did you have Thriller on, Bill? 8-track cassette?
No.
High 8, something like that? Did you have it on vinyl?
7 years ago, I bought the Thriller Anniversary DVD, or whenever that was released. It was
like
7 years ago. And I was thinking that The Girl Is Mine is the equivalent of Bill Wennington and Luke Longley in the 96 Bulls.
I really question your analogy. It's the equivalent of Billy Zane and Titanic.
Yeah, but here's the thing. People think the 72-win Bulls are the greatest team ever because they won 72 games, like they think Thriller is the greatest album ever because it sold the most records. But fundamentally, it can't be the greatest record ever because The Girl Is Mine, as you said, was the first single, which I forgot. I just knew it was one of the singles. But that eliminates it from the conversation right there. That's one of the worst songs ever made, ever.
I am not going to deny, you know. Now, is Luke Longley one of the worst players ever?
Well, you're talking about a sport that has five people that can play at once. The Bulls, those five people, one of those five at all times was either Bill Wennington or Luke Longley. You cannot tell me that is the greatest team of all time when if they were going against anybody who had a good center, they're at a severe disadvantage. They just were.
Do you think every group of five has to have someone who is either completely irrelevant or worse than that? Like, I'm the guy who saw, Backstreet Boys concerts when Howie D would get introduced. You know, they'd go around and Nick Carter would get a cheer and Brian would get a cheer. And then Howie D would get introduced. Hmm. And Howie D looked like he was playing Jesus in, the Jupiter, Florida production of Godspell. And the silence that would come over the institution would be unbelievable. In a group of five, there may be somebody. There may be a Bill Wyman. There may be always someone who's just hanging on.
Well, I always thought four was the optimal number, really, for anything. A TV show, if you're going to have, Seinfeld, four people.
There were four great Beatles.
And the
Rolling Stones had five, and one of them was Bill Wyman.
The 86 Celtics, the greatest basketball team of all time. The Big Three plus Dennis Johnson. Danny Ainge, good player, but really any could have been any shooting guard. They still would have been as good.
But isn't it possible that five means that you have to have one guy who is not that good, that there just isn't enough beer for everybody?
It depends on the genre.
What can you think? I mean, what's been like a real – and I don't just mean like the dream team because they never really had to play at, their optimal level. But what would be like a five where every member of the five contributed at a high level.
Well, let's talk about the great bands. Like U2 is four guys.
Right.
The Beatles, as you said, were four guys. Rolling Stones was five?
Yeah.
And really, they really only needed four.
Well, they do need someone to play bass. They need two guitars,
When you go out to dinner, the best number to go out to dinner with is four people. You get that fifth, it's a little weird, because sometimes you'll have the situations where two people are talking, then the other two people are talking, but that fifth guy is kind of just lingering.
I think if you have five, it means that someone has to designate themselves as the point guard. You know, four is an organic organization where everybody can contribute. When there's five, somebody has to be the distributor. Somebody has to figure out, it's your turn to talk, it's your turn to take a solo. It's your turn to pick up all of the dirty clothes off the floor. Now I've got five in my family, and five works great. So maybe five for a family is a good call.
I got another example.
Okay.
Pre-game shows. You don't want to go five on your pre-game show. You want to go four, maybe even three, and have the fourth guy not really talk that much.
But. I give you a big yes on that, I want to see Bernie Kosar on a pregame show next year.
Disgraced athletes is a pregame show?
It's more interesting than disgrace to me. It's fascinating. There was that Don DeLillo book, White Noise, and the whole second part of White Noise is somebody saying over and over again, this is the meaning of Babette. It's this line that has this great, this great meaning. That's the line I keep thinking when I see what's happened to Bernie Kosar, because that was his ex-wife's name. This is the meaning of Babette. So, you and I talked about Bernie. I loved Bernie. So, I'm rooting for the big Bernie comeback immediately.
I'm always fascinated by any college athlete who's playing at a high Division I level who graduates early.
Yeah. Oh, the guy just looks so smart,
Yeah.
I mean, and I mean, that's my favorite college football game of all time, that Orange Bowl game. Anyone in my family can say one of our favorite phrases ever, which is, Irving Fryer, he dropped the ball. I mean, everything about that was, you know, Howard Schnellenberger looking like he was in a performance of Music Man on the sideline. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that game. And the superstar of it is Bernie, you know?
I would argue that that was really the heyday of college sports. Not just for football, but basketball. You look at like 84 and 85 and the football games that are happening then, but also the basketball. And, you know, the Villanova game was in 85.
You know, I went to a U2 concert that night. That night that Villanova game was played was the first time U2 ever headlined Madison Square Garden. Hmm. And before the show started, somebody came out to the audience and called me and my editor, Jim Henke, backstage. And we went backstage and we went into a room and there was an open bottle of champagne. And the guys all had glasses of champagne. They handed us a glass and they said, we just wanted to, you know, to toast us all for this moment and thank you for making it happen for us. And we had a glass of champagne with them. We came back to our seats. We watched the show. And then after the show was over, we went back to this, like, after room in Madison Square Garden, and it was the last 2 seconds of the Villanova game.
It's a good
night. I remember seeing the little two, you know, in the corner there as they were trying to, as Villanova was trying to inbound the ball at the end of the game. So I'll always remember that day.
Not, maybe you don't remember the 2001 Michael Jackson anniversary special quite with the same fondness.
Is that the one where Marlon Brando came out with a chair and started telling this hideous story about a child who'd been stabbed with a knife?
It's amazing television. The whole thing.
It's like the craziest thing that ever happened, right?
Well, at one point, Jackson's out there with Timberlake's band. Which one was that? NSYNC?
Yes. Timberlake's
or
band.
Or Backstreet.
Yes.
Yeah. Comes out with them and he's doing his thing, and it was, you know, not that long after the allegations and the payoffs, you know, and
right.
It's just, I don't know, it seemed kind of, maybe you don't want him out there with NSYNC, but.
Well, wasn't it not that long after 9/11? Am I remembering that
it
right?
Wasn't. It was a couple.
Like really eerily proximate to 9/11, and was it in New York? Like at Madison Square Garden? I have a vague memory of it.
It was at Madison Square Garden, and if it's ever on, I urge you all to watch it. And what was
the Brando thing's on YouTube? I know that much because I went looking for that. That's just crazy. Yeah.
Jackson's voice is just awful in it because they do All Be There and he just kills it. And then I think they must have made the decision to just switch to recorded for him.
Oh,
but
wow.
He sings with the mic on. He sings I'll Be There and it's like really, really, really bad. I don't think people realize like how much he slipped over these last 10 years. I think that tour would have been, unless he lip-synced everything, I don't think if he had done a 2009 tour, I don't think he could have done it.
It's hard to know, you know. It's hard to know. It's not like, you know, the clip they released from the show, he actually sounded pretty good. And I think that he had people around him that would have protected him from getting in situations where he couldn't hit notes and stuff. Remember, you know, like, here are two acts you would rarely hear mentioned in the same sentence. Michael Jackson, ABBA. Things about these two guys, they were the last two groups of their kind to be expected to do it all. ABBA would never now have been expected to play instruments and sing all that stuff live. And they did when they went out live. They all played, you know, they played instruments, the tambourines, the guitars, the keyboards. They did it all live, no backing track. Michael did all that dancing and all that singing live in his heyday. No backtrack, no lip sync. You know,
right.
Anyone who dances that much now, it's expected that they'll lip sync, from Janet to Britney to all those guys. And he did it all. So I don't know what it would have been like if he'd gone out this time, but I think they would have had his back in terms of making him look good. Let's put it that way.
You know, I was talking to somebody about this. I don't think it was on a podcast, so forgive me if I'm going over the same territory again. But he's one of the few guys that was famous, or few anybody's, who was famous really from the moment he could remember anything about his life all the way through to the end. Like, how many people have pulled that off?
Or was in the business of attempting to be famous?
He was never not really, really famous.
Well, you can, I mean, if you're going to be technical about it, you could say that, you know, you could say you can see him in that audition tape for Motown, and he's sentient, like he's old enough to have remembered if his favorite team had won the World Series or something.
Was he like seven?
And they weren't quote unquote famous then. But you're right. From the time he began but we kind of remember. And I think that's why he was drawn to other child stars, too, you know.
Oh, no, you're not going to feed
O'Neal,
that.
This
oh, I see what you mean. I thought you were going to say, I thought that's why he was drawn to children.
No, like Emmanuel.
That whole
was,
argument.
Like people, you know, he was drawn to be around those people who hadn't had the kind of, you know, the childhood we're talking about. You know, my theory about child stars is, they're like Tyson in a way. You know, they live this very structured life. They do exactly as they're told. And then at one point, they don't want to do what anybody tells them to do anymore. You know?
Yeah.
And they don't really want to do much of anything. And idle time for them is very bad news. As long as they're working, it's good. But when they stop working, and they really want to stop working because they don't want anybody to tell them what to do, bad things happen. And I think that's what we see in the cases of child stars left to their own devices.
This sounds like you should be pitching this as a show. When Child Stars Go Wrong, hosted by Chris Connolly.
But the serial number on Emmanuel Lewis did not match the serial number listed at the bottom of his birth certificate at the San Mateo Courthouse.
When Macaulay Culkin started smoking, that's when the wheels came off. So I got to ask you about McNair. A little touchy, still a little fresh. People don't really like talking, you know, bad about the dead, beloved athlete, all that stuff. But yeah, you're a family man and so am I. This guy was, you know, had this mistress, had this party condo basically two minutes from his house, was involved with multiple stuff, had a wife and four kids. I wasn't sure how I was supposed to feel about this whole thing.
Well, my question is, what are the athletes going to do after the ESPYs? Because no one is having sex anymore.
You think this is it? This killed
after,
it?
After Steve McNair and the boxer in South America, they're going to play Parcheesi, or they're going to do beer pong, or everyone's going to go like sing karaoke or do Dance Dance Revolution, because God knows no one is hooking up anymore.
So you think not since Magic in 1991 has there been this kind of a scare thrown at the athletes?
Who would have dreamed that, you know, if there's a chance that your hookup has a gun or can get a gun, probably a bad idea, you know? Of course, I thought the same thing after Phil Spector, and I guess I was wrong. But I think, I think that's really going to, I'm sure the rules will codify themselves a little bit in terms of who you have to watch out for. But I think tonight we're going to see a lot more clean living in Los Angeles than we might have a month and a half ago.
Yeah, and that, you know, it's not like we're making light of it because this is a fresh thing. The guy died. He had left four kids, all that stuff. But
no, it's a tragedy, you know.
Yeah.
It's a reminder of, like, when you step off the curb of your life, you walk into traffic. And you may think you're in charge because you're the dominant person in the relationship. You're the athlete, or you're the wealthy guy, or you're the man, or you're the old guy. Any way that you might imagine yourself in that situation when you think, but you're not. You've stepped off the curb and you're in traffic, and you cannot predict what happens after that happens. So that's what I would say. And you're right. We don't want to make light of it. But it's about the uncertainty that comes over you, that comes over anyone, when you leave your comfort zone and you think you're in control and you get involved with people that you know absolutely nothing about. So I think that's the lesson there.
Yeah, there was this whole sub-story that nobody really delved into. A couple people did a little bit. You know, Jason Whitlock did, and a couple columnists. And sometimes when you write the counter argument to the stuff that people are reading, sometimes it seems like you're pushing a little too hard to just be
the
contrarian.
Well, yeah, and also I tend to pull back a little from the knee-jerk moralism also, you know.
Yeah.
We don't know what McNair's family was like. We don't know what their situation was. We don't know. You know, whatever, you know, every family is different and you know, there may have been reasons for everything, and it's difficult to judge from the outside.
You can't.
But
at the same time, the interesting part to me that was never really delved into, and maybe it will be in some sort of magazine piece or outside the lines, who knows. But, you know, these guys, this is an accepted thing with sports and with professional athletes, that they kind of make their own rules. And, you know, you see it trickle out sometimes, but these are guys that are on the road. They have women in different city, but they also have the wives at home. And, you know, you and I both work in the sports world. We've heard a lot of stories. this, people were kind of surprised by this McNair thing. My God, he's married and he's with a 20-year-old waitress. But actually, if you work in the sports world, it wasn't surprising at all. I wasn't remotely shocked. I mean, I was obviously a little shocked by how it ended, but not to find out that this was a guy who was carrying on this affair 2 miles from his house. Not shocking, actually. And that's the part I wonder if that storyline is going to gain life over the next couple of weeks.
Well, like, it's not just, you know, as we also know, it's not just sports figures.
No.
It's not even just entertainers. You know, if you read a biography of Teddy Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's uncle had a separate family 10 blocks away from where his real family was.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know, I interviewed Bob Crane's wife once, Bob Crane's widow. You remember Bob Crane?
Yes.
He was the star of Hogan's Heroes. He was
one of the top five weirdest celebrities, I would say, ever.
All that, you know, was the first guy to really get involved with videotaping his conquests.
Yeah.
And,
the Jackie Robinson of sexual tapes.
That's absolutely right. And I talked to his widow, and I said, wow, what were you, you know, what did you think of all this? And she said, they meant nothing to him. He treated them like toilet paper.
Yeah.
And that's what made it okay. Because he treated his, in her mind, because he treated the other women like toilet paper, then it was cool.
But there's this whole alternate world that I don't think the average person knows about. And as you said, it's not just athletes, it's celebrities, it's politicians, it's people who have power and money and prestige or whatever. And they can basically make their own rules with this stuff. And whether the wives know or not, or maybe they don't want to know, it's a little, the best show that portrayed how the woman is conflicted with this is The Sopranos, ironically.
Okay.
Because Carmela Soprano, she knew Tony was effing around.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she had to make a choice. Do I want to file for divorce, take half this guy's money, and basically, you know, I'm out of the merry-go-round. If I leave, I get his paychecks, but I don't get to live in this giant house. I don't get to be Tony Soprano's wife. So it's almost like they're balancing what's important to me or whatever. And I think this happens a lot more than people think.
Things for people. It's, you know, it's family and community and, you know, I mean, it's not just money. It's like, what are my responsibilities to children and to the people we care about and to our families? And so this is this is obviously a situation people come up against over and over again. And the tragedy is, you know, again, when you leave what you're familiar with, you know, one of the things about Los Angeles, you know, obviously, is that people come from so many different parts of the world. You don't know much about them sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, but as we see, that's true everywhere. You don't know what you're getting into, and it can be dangerous.
I was shocked. The one thing that shocked me reading the McNair stuff was that they kept using the word blindsided. His wife was blindsided. She had no idea, you know, and that got me thinking, like, you know, maybe she really didn't have any idea. Like, maybe she thought it was perfectly reasonable that this guy had owned a condo 2 miles from their house. She never even questioned this. I don't know. I just thought that was weird. I know if I told my wife, hey, good news. I'm renting a house two miles away. Don't ever go there. Okay.
I need a workspace to work on my book.
I'm ready in office.
I have to make sure I have no distractions. I just enjoy being around all of you so much that it's hard for me to, you know, there are a million excuses and a million, you know, ways to make those sort of things happen, I'm sure.
And my single...
at the end of the day, it's like this, you know, we are defined, you know, we define people in their lives so much by their passing. You know, that's the other sad thing. It's like, we all have fantastic images of McNair. You know, he was so brave. He was so tough. You know, he was so strong. And assuming all this happened, this should have been just a blip on his radar or maybe something we wouldn't even known about, you know. But now, because of the manner of his departure, it becomes the period on his sentence. And
yeah, it's too bad.
And
I mean, it's first sentence probably.
Well, I don't. I mean, you know, we're kind of caught up in it now, but.
I think if people think of Steve McNair 15 years from now, that one of the first things they're going to remember is that's the murder suicide guy.
Well, that's possible.
You don't think so?
That's possible. That's, you know, I don't know. I, you know, sometimes these things, you know, the tape we'll keep seeing is him, you know, throwing the ball, taking the hits, putting his hands on his helmet like that, you know?
I don't know. This is pretty weird. I mean, it's going to be hard to think of Arturo Gatti at this point. This is one of the, you know, boxing's great, great warriors, so many good fights, all that stuff. I'm going to think of him now as the guy who got strangled by his wife, if that's true.
By a purse strap, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he must have gotten hit by his wife first, right? I don't know how he could have. We'll
sketchy
see.
Details. Seemed like he was drunk.
Oh, and, is that right? Okay.
Yeah, he was maybe passed out or something. Maybe she. Mm.
That was a strange story. I'm sure we'll hear more about it.
She has not been accused yet. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking about our outside the lines and these 60s guys. This has been a goldmine so far this summer.
There's a lot going on. There's certainly
stories.
A lot going on, you know.
Talk about the stuff you're doing for SportsCenter.
Well, let's see. We just finished our My Wish series, of course. So
yeah, let's talk about it.
That was a lot of fun. It was great to meet those kids and to get to spend some time with their families. And then to see them go off and have great wishes. And we had a bunch of great kids this year, you know, from Ian Gregory, our kid undergoing chemotherapy. You got to hang out with the Cowboys,
yeah.
To Cole Johansson, who got a great time with CP3 in Winston-Salem. So, I don't know. I really get such a kick out of meeting these kids and their families. My gosh, their families are so strong, you know, and you really, you know, these sort of things really test families. And it's not like they all of a sudden whip up this strength or character or something. It's like it's been there all along. It's like all the inside jokes and the fun that you have, it like all comes into play when these kids get sick. Because if you didn't have that, you'd melt like a crayon on a radiator. So it's amazing to get to see them. And then, of course, it's great to, you know, to see them have wishes. I also think you see something about the athletes when they do this stuff, you know, or the teams when they go into teams. You know, I like seeing, like, who always goes over and has some fun, or who has somebody's back and hangs out and stuff. So you get little insights there, like the Jimmy Rollins wish. It was not hard to imagine why that team was so successful. They were kidding each other. They had a great time. Rollins was, like, getting in Ryan Howard's face and Victorino and all the rest of it. And that, I think, is a side you don't always get to see. And it's fun that we're able to bring that in, too.
I was going to ask you about, I don't want to put you in the spot, but was there an athlete that maybe you liked or maybe you had no opinion on who, after you did one of these segments, you were like, wow, I want to tell everybody I know what a freaking awesome guy that guy is. I want to have him join my family.
You know, you mean that he's a really good guy, like a fantastic guy?
Awesome guy. Like you were just, you couldn't, you left and you're like, I can't stop thinking about what a great guy that guy is.
Well, you remember, I don't go on the wishes, you know, because we want to save money. So I just watch it.
No. I'm saying when you see all the raw footage, you're editing them and stuff.
Drew Brees for the Saints last year. I mean, you know, we gave him a very young kid. He was a great kid. He was a terrific kid, Devin. And, but, you know, he's a little kid, so he's not necessarily going to plug in right away. I mean, you know what it's like with little kids. They get a little embarrassed. They go, but, and he just never let it discourage him. He never let him stop connecting. And so over the course of a whole day, you could sort of see him working to get this kid to open up. And it totally worked. And by the end of the day, he's carrying the kid on his shoulders and stuff. And so I actually saw him at the ESPYs, like, afterwards, and I said, hey, you did a great job with our kid. Thank you so much. He said, yeah, thanks a lot. I said, no, I understand what you did with our kid. I heard what it was like that, you know, every now and then the kid had to take a time out and stuff. I really appreciate the trouble you went to. And so he got it there. So, yeah, Drew Brees went on my love list after that because he did a fantastic job with our kid.
So from that point on, you're always rooting for him.
I'm down with Drew Brees. Yeah,
you're down with the Brees.
I like all these. I mean, I'm grateful for all these guys. If anyone ever sees me at a kid's birthday party, I look like Courage the Cowardly Dog. I'm just nervous. Is everybody having fun? Are we having a good time? All the rest of it. So when these guys go off on their wishes, I'm the same way. So when I get the call back and it's like they had a great time and somebody was great to them and stuff, I am the most relieved man on the planet. So I like all these athletes for coming through for these kids.
You don't have to name names, but has there ever been one that, like, didn't go well or you really had to, like, save in the editing room or it was awkward or just,
you know,
the athlete wasn't into
it? You know, if they're willing to do this on TV, they're into it, you know.
Yeah.
It's like they understand. And I'm not saying they do stuff for the cameras, but no one's going to be dragged into doing something like this, you know, because they could just as easily give these wishes in private. So when guys show up for this stuff, they're on point, and so no, we haven't really had that problem. You know, it's fun when we do team wishes, like for individuals, and the team comes out to be part of it. Like I'm trying to think now, like the Ortiz wish, the David Ortiz wish. It's like the whole Red Sox organization was out there giving our guy a good time and stuff. So it's fun when it starts out as one, then it becomes the whole team. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of love all the way around. So that's a neat aspect of them, too.
I got to say, the thing that has changed the most about sports this decade, and it's never mentioned, if you're going to do like a recap of the decade and say, what are the big fundamental changes? And obviously you'd say HD, you'd say the league starting their own networks, you know, the typical stuff you'd expect. The thing that I don't think people discuss enough and hasn't got enough credit is how teams have gotten really smart about getting involved with their community, and they kind of have embraced how important that is. And I really think it's something that started this decade, because I've seen it just with my Boston teams. Those teams, the Red Sox didn't give a crap about anybody locally in the old, before the new owners came in. Like they just didn't value it. They didn't care. Same for the Celtics before this decade. But now I think if a team isn't really involved with the community and doing stuff like that, it almost seems weird. It's like,
well,
why
know, the
are you
thing
doing stuff?
I mean, and you know, this is nothing new, but you know, the thing that's always so interesting about reading the sports writing from the 50s and stuff, you know,
yeah.
For me, you know, is like the coverage of the Dodgers or something when they were in Brooklyn before I was born, is that all these guys went to work together, you know. They didn't make so different money. They all took the same subways or the same buses, you know. They all had off-season jobs and beer distributorships and stuff, you know. They were all, you know, they were all on the same economic level, and obviously that changed in a big way. So in a way, this kind of community involvement is a way to redress, you know, what we've sort of seen, you know, elsewhere and stuff. You know, what we've seen in the disparity now in terms of incomes and stuff like that. I still feel like the players need to step up more as an organization or as individuals towards making a difference. I don't feel like we have correct me if I'm wrong, and obviously there are great players out there, but where's our Bono? Where's our George Clooney? Like, where's the guy who makes a ton of money, who gets smart and really uses his celebrity and his influence and the incomes of players and other people like to really, like, advocate for something, to really make something happen? There really ought to be more of that, I think. You know, more systematized use by individual players or groups of players, not necessarily on behalf of a team or a league, but stepping up to get really smart about something and really making things happen. I don't feel like we've seen enough of that yet.
That's interesting, yeah, because usually the impetus comes from the commissioners or, you know, the teams themselves, but you rarely see, as you said, the Bono type.
No studio is telling George Clooney, you really ought to go down to Darfur, you know, and you ought to make that a big focus of your activism. You know?
Yeah, but is that something that ties into somebody who's an artist is naturally always thinking about the world around him, whereas an athlete is just thinking about their bodies and themselves?
That would certainly be the stereotype, and I think in a lot of cases that's true. But you know what it is? It's like every single athlete has a foundation. Why? I guess it's a tax write-off or some kind, or you hire your brother-in-law to run a bicycle race.
It's not a good idea.
But it's baloney. It's inefficient.
Yeah.
It doesn't help anybody. It's like a major athlete who is incredibly famous and who has enormous influence, you know, should not have like a cute little foundation.
I agree.
He should be making big things happen. Not with Nike, not with the team, not with the league, but on his own or her own.
Yeah, or, you know, maybe you team up with 20 other athletes and you create a real foundation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Don't just give your brother-in-law a job. You know?
I think what happens a lot of times is that these people, as you said, it looks good for them. Oh, yeah, I have a charity foundation. This is great. I'm a good guy. I care about things. And then it's like, oh, yeah. And also my brother-in-law, my cousin, and my aunt are the three running it. So they get jobs out of it.
And they're out of my hair and stuff. I mean, obviously, that's how production deals are done in Hollywood, too, right?
Well, there's been some pretty good features over the years about how little that these, by the time you cross all the T's and dot all the I's how little a lot of these foundations make because they're so poorly run.
Yeah,
the people running them.
Not to say these guys don't. These guys all care. It's just what we've seen in celebrity. And again, just like you say, over the last 10 years, is how do you manipulate the world given your celebrity and income? You know, Angelina Jolie, George Clooney, Bono. It's like everybody starts out laughing, and then it turns out it actually works. And there's no reason why elite athletes couldn't do that in the same way without these, you know, without the league or the teams or stuff being involved or their shoe companies.
See, I'm against Angelina Jolie.
You are
throwing
so
that
wrong.
Out there. I'm against her.
You are so wrong.
She has too many kids. She films movies. They live in like 5 houses.
If you spent 5 minutes with her, you would look like Linus talking about Miss Othmar.
I'm not saying she's beautiful.
Funny. She is so charming. She can be totally down to earth.
I'm in the Angelina Jolie tent
with the all access laminate. I'm a fan.
So. No, just remember she's nuts. Wasn't that long ago when she was a lunatic? She was wearing Billy Bob Thornton's blood around her neck.
Are there any photographs of you from high school or from the College of Holy Cross you want to know about?
Well,
you know?
I'm just saying 7-8 years ago, wearing blood around her neck from Billy Bob Thornton.
And you're saying that like it's a bad thing.
You're right. I wish I had some of Billy Bob Thornton's blood.
It's called commitment. You remember? It's like commitment.
I just have a problem.
What Steve Martin once said about comedy, it's not the idea, it's the commitment to the idea.
Well, I just have a problem with these celebs that keep adding kids, but think it's a good idea for them to live in like 5 different cities and move around, and they're with nannies 24 hours a day. Your kids probably aren't coming out too well. That's my expert opinion.
I can understand looking at someone from a distance and saying that. I think, you know, in my limited time with Miss Jolie, I have confidence in her desire to be a good parent, a funny, down-to-earth parent.
You're such a Kool-Aid drinker.
Hmm?
You're a Kool-Aid drinker. You're drinking the Jolie Kool-Aid.
I don't mind. I'm in there. I can't help it.
Not a red flag that she barely talks to her dad?
The first story I ever did on her, we wound up having lunch. It was her and her brother and her dad, and they were all talking, and her dad had a copy of a biography of Albert Schweitzer. And there was a pause in the conversation, and for some unforeseen reason, I thought it was my job to fill the pause in the conversation. I wouldn't do a stupid thing like that today, but I did then. And I said to John Voight, I said, "I see you're reading a biography of Albert Schweitzer." That's all I said. Two sets of eyes, at least in my memory, rolled back in their head, and John Voight turned to me and began to answer that question. Somewhere in the universe, John Voight is still answering that question. As far as I know, that answer like began, and like people got elected president, and people won World Series, and the Super Bowls happened, 9/11, and John Voight just continued to answer that question. So I could kind of understand wanting a little space from the filibuster after a while.
All right. Well, this has all been leading to my big question for you.
Okay.
Because you're going to come on the podcast a few more times this year.
All right.
You know, I don't know if you realize, but
I'm of course honored to hear. I sort of think of myself as like the, you're Calvin Trillin in the old Tonight Show. You know,
the Terry Garr.
We're like, well, further down the couch than that, maybe.
Come on.
We're like 50 minutes to go. Terry Garr. I'll be Terry Garr. Terry Garr.
We're like 7 for 7 on good podcasts.
Well, I'm grateful that you think so. I am.
Little underrated thing going on right now. This is the last year of the decade. You don't think of it that way because it's double zeros, but
yeah,
really, this is the last year of the aughts or the double zeros or whatever the hell we're going to call it.
The decade we never came up with a name for, right?
Yeah, and that's why people don't realize, like, wow, it's the end of the decade. Like, if the 90s were ending, we'd be, you know, remember 10 years ago, the 90s were ending. Wow, the 90s. Oh, let's talk about the 90s. What happened? In your opinion,
yes,
the defining great movie of this decade.
Oh, the
because I had a huge dinner argument about this a couple of days ago. Here are the qualifications.
All right,
excellence when it came out, rewatchability, and originality.
Wow, that's a tough one. But my mind went like,
well, you
trust
your
blank. What?
I was going to say, trust your Gladwell Blink instincts. First movie that popped to mind is probably your answer.
I don't know. I don't know that any movie is popping to mind. I was all ready to tell you 9/11 and Facebook.
So I threw a curveball at you.
I did not see that coming. I may have to mull this over a little bit. I don't really have a blink instinct on that. Let's see.
I think there's an answer.
Well, go ahead.
You're going to be happy by the answer.
All right.
I think it's Almost Famous.
Almost Famous.
Came out in 2000.
Okay. Came out in 2000, so you say it just gets under the wire, huh?
That's first year of the decade.
Interesting. Like, so that would, like, in the way that, did Goodfellas come out in 1990, and that sort of became the best film of the 90s?
Do you think that was the I would have said Shawshank for the 90s.
No, I would go with Goodfellas over Shawshank, as you and I both.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, not even a tough call for me.
Hmm.
Yeah. No, Goodfellas, I mean, and you talk about watchability, you know. Aren't you the guy who broke down the greatest sequence of my movie life, the and then he kissed me sequence?
Oh yeah,
that's the only sequence I've ever seen in a movie and wanted to stand up and applaud after it was over.
Well, it was funny, it's Almost Famous didn't even get nominated, but so we got Gladiators in the mix, Traffic, Lord of the Rings, we have. I mean, I wouldn't pick this, but Brokeback Mountain, in terms of being memorable and stuff like that, I think
right.
It has to be at least mentioned. And that's really it.
And you mentioned those movies, and you know what I, you know, and you know what
Departed?
I say? Pardon me?
Departed?
Departed, yeah.
No Country for Old Men, Slumdog Millionaire, Chicago.
I mean, fine, all of them fine, admirable.
But not rewatchable.
But love. That's the thing. Love. Do you love those things? You know, there's a lot to admire, but what is there? I have to check to make sure it came out in 2000.
What is it?
I think I know what my favorite movie of the decade is.
Okay.
But I'm not even sure it came out in the aughts. I'm going to go with, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Wow. See, this is why we would have had a good movie review show.
Mm-hmm.
We should have been the new Siskel and Ebert. I hated that movie.
Oh God,
I don't like the Coen Brothers.
I get it right under the wire. 2000, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? My favorite movie of the last 10 years.
Well, maybe that should have been my question. Maybe there is no answer to what was the best movie of the decade because you really can't answer that because it's everybody's
well,
never
their
say, answer.
I mean, it's interesting. What you would say is that the movies really bifurcated, that you had movies that you admired and the movies that were popcorn movies, and it was not a good decade for the twining of the two. You know,
yes.
The economics of movies meant that they had to be like thrill rides in theme parks, the big ones, and that these all the critical, you know, metrics of how you assess a movie were right out the window. Nobody cared about them. You know, there were maybe six movies a year you could discuss intelligently. You know,
right.
Almost Famous would be one of them. Shawshank would be one of them. You know, movies made by auteurs, you could talk about them. And then the rest of them, not only, you would even be wrong to say that you didn't like them as a critic, your opinions were completely irrelevant because your way of analyzing me was completely irrelevant. Those guys who could make the high-low movies, they just didn't do it that way this year, in those 10 years, because the economics forbade it, you know.
You're talking about movies that were really good but also have pop culture relevance. And if you look at the 90s, I'm just reading the list of movies that
90s
were nominated.
Jam with them, right?
Well, these are just movies that were nominated. This isn't even the complete list of all the movies. But so you had Ghost, you had Goodfellas, Silence of the Lambs, Few Good Men,
yep,
Scent of a Woman, Schindler's List, The Fugitive, Forrest Gump, Pulp Fiction, Shawshank, Braveheart, Fargo, Jerry Maguire, Titanic.
Yeah.
As Good as It Gets, Good Will Hunting, Saving Private Ryan, and I guess The Sixth Sense. 99 was like a very underrated year for movies.
And now part of that is us getting older and not being locked in to these sort of things is the same way. So that there's that.
Oh, I don't agree with that. I don't agree. I don't think the movies this decade, I think they were more niche oriented, but you didn't have a lot of those movies that put it this way, like TNT has been probably shows more movies from the 90s than they do from the 2000s. Like they show Castaway all the time. Castaway actually fits the bill of a movie that for whatever reason has kind of gained a second life on cable and
right.
whatever, but there just haven't been a ton of movies like that. You wouldn't want to watch The Lord of the Rings over and over again, would you?
No, well, my kids do.
Or The Pianist?
No, it doesn't work for me, you know. It doesn't I admire them, but it's not like I know why you would say something like Almost Famous, because there are four or five scenes in there you just, oh, I saw something new there. Look, it's human behavior. Look, you know. Look
it's
at,
so
look
well
at,
done.
Look at Frances McDormand, you know.
Yeah. It's just so well done and so well acted, and it didn't do well, which really shakes my faith.
Well, but as luck would have it, my wife and I were sitting in the auditorium next to Cameron's mother and behind Cameron and Cameron's wife when he won the Oscar.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people know and love Cameron. I'm like one of 1,000 people who know and love Cameron. Mm. So there's nothing special about me. But that's just, you know, just being that close to that and being that happy for someone, that's like a Rip Taylor moment. That's like somebody, or like the Harlem Globetrotters moment. It's like somebody running down the aisle and throwing a bucket of happiness in your face. It's like, it's just, it was so great for him and so great for his family. And I remember Frances McDormand reaching back to his mother as he went up to accept his award and saying, "We did it, we did it."
Yeah, and I think if the people that were involved in that movie, it's probably very special to them. And that's what I feel like this decade's been missing. Like, we've had movies like The Departed and Crash, like these big ensemble movies.
You know where they all
went,
Bill?
No,
they all started doing TV. The movies you're talking about, that's The Sopranos.
Oh, yeah,
that's
you're probably
Mad
right.
Men.
Yeah.
That's like one guy. That's David, you know, that's The Wire. That's like one guy, you know, with a vision, allowed to pursue it as a writer and a visionary. You just don't get to do that in movies anymore, but you got to do it on TV in 2000 and onward, you know.
See, just I knew you'd have an answer for me.
You got to do it on the small screen.
I knew you'd have an answer.
That's the stuff we love to watch over and over again now.
Yeah, and when you think about it, Almost Famous came out in 2000. Sopranos, I think, started in 99 or 2000, somewhere in there.
The Sopranos is the great film of of this decade.
I would argue The Wire, too.
Right. The Wire is the indie film of the decade, right?
That's an awesome point.
But that's where those guys went to go to work. You could not make an independent film in 2000 and have a chance of getting an audience. And if you tried, the studio would eat you alive. But on TV, they let you do your thing.
I think there were some really good indies. Like, I liked Lost in Translation. I liked Sideways. Brokeback Mountain, I thought was really good. There's like 10 of those, but nothing like Pulp Fiction.
I think you named the Holy Trinity there, right?
Little Miss Sunshine's damn close. I think Juno's fairly close.
And then, you know, and the Pixar movies were good, too, you know. But, yeah, all those charming movies in the same way. But charming, you know, like you wouldn't want to necessarily say great with a capital G, but you'd say, wow, those really worked. Those were cool movies.
Another one that I thought was really good, but not – it's a little long. Now, from a rewatchability standpoint, it hurts a little bit. But Gladiator, I think – Gladiator is an amazing movie. It's really, really good.
And it didn't win Best Director, right? It's like...
No, it won Best Picture,
I just keep thinking of seeing Ridley Scott there in the audience. Like, that is a Ridley Scott movie. That is the apotheosis of what Ridley Scott's tried to do in movies for years and years. And every single person connected with that movie is going up on stage and giving a speech. And then there he is, sitting in his chair.
Like, you know what? I forgot a movie. I think Dark Knight, potentially.
I think for
it's a little early.
I think for my son's generation, that's going to be the movie. You know, that's going to be the most beloved movie of this era.
Like, so maybe that's our answer.
Look back and they say the movie that not what
that might be our answer.
Yeah. Well, for them, that will be their must movie. The one that matters the most.
I got to tell you, it's been on all the time, and I it's an amazing movie. It's just one of the best movies I've ever seen. I'm changing my answer to Dark Knight. I don't know why I didn't think of that earlier. I think Almost Famous I'm going to put second. It's a little early with Dark Knight. I don't know if it's going to resonate with me 7-8 years from now, but man, I just thought it's so well done. The music, it doesn't quit. There isn't like a bad scene. It doesn't drag. The acting's fantastic.
For me, it's a movie, and I think there's a weakness, and I don't think it's enough of a Batman movie. You know, I think they have a Batman problem in Dark Knight, particularly when Batman is Batman.
Dark Knight was the Titanic of its decade.
Well, but Titanic had luminous performances from its stars, you know.
You don't think Titanic, Heath Ledger qualifies?
Titanic made Leo and Kate into what they became, whether or not they, you know, enjoyed the experience or not.
The Batman movie, you know, basically Heath Ledger now is in this category of guys who died too soon, basically based on that performance of Brokeback Mountain.
Yes, yeah. Well, and, really Brokeback Mountain. I mean, there was, Dark Knight was the payoff on Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting about this decade has been actors appear, you know, it used to be the other way around. You would appear in these big blockbusters, and then that would enable you to do the intimate, powerful acting job.
Yeah.
That's essentially the career of every female actress from the 80s. But the idea was reversed this year. It's like actresses like Jennifer Connelly or Halle Berry or people like that, they got Oscars, and then they got their payday. Halle Berry got an Oscar, and then she did Catwoman.
It's true.
Jennifer Connelly got an Oscar, and then she did The Hulk.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of moving in that direction would have seemed insane 20 years ago.
You have to go.
I guess
you
got
to go. You got to do stuff. Well, we'll have you back. I think some more about the movie of the decade.
I will.
Because now I went into this thinking Almost Famous was my choice, but now I got to think about Dark Knight.
Now we've disrupted the force on you. So.
Yeah, we have a little bit. But as always, a pleasure to have you on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline.
Thank you, Bill.
What else? Anything you want to plug? Any plugs?
Just keep watching SportsCenter. We have more cool stories coming, and we look forward to serving them up for you.
All right. Always a pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Target percent off. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just breaking news, which frankly cannot go unstated. This summer, Subway is teaming up with Live Nation to bring you great food and great music for a great value. Right now, buy a Subway $5 footlong and get a Live Nation concert ticket for just $5 to some of the hottest Live Nation shows like Nickelback, The Fray, and Crew Fest 2. Ticket price does not include fees. See the nearest Subway for details.